Thank you to those who've come back from yesterday, and thanks to those who weren't here yesterday. The session today is different. In a sense, it builds on yesterday, but it's also good for standalone. So if you weren't here yesterday, hopefully you'll still be able to follow along with what we're talking about. Yesterday's focus was the God who gives hope despite oppression, a message of hope for persecuted Christians, but also a message of hope for everybody who is a child of the living God through Jesus Christ, his Son. And we started in Genesis, we looked at the story of Joseph, and we finished in Revelation, but we did leave out a few books in the middle. And so we're building on that today. First of all, an introduction to Barnabas Fund. We are an international aid agency where the head office is based in England, and we serve Christians who suffer disadvantage, oppression, or persecution because of their faith. We're motivated in large part by this verse in Galatians 6 and verse 10, where Paul says, "Let us do good to all people," and we have a special calling on our ministry to the second part of that, especially to those who belong to the family of believers. Our model of ministry is entirely Christian. We don't go outside the Christian community for support, so it's from Christians. We work with trusted partners in country, so we work through Christians. And lastly, consistent with that verse in Galatians 6, we support Christians who are affected. And so that's our model of ministry. And we fund ministry under a variety of headings or categories, which are scrolling around on the screen, which go from, immediate urgent relief when necessary, right through to self-sustainability when possible. And we're interested in meeting people's spiritual needs as well as their physical needs. And so that's the way that we operate. And in terms of where we operate, wherever there is a need. And so over the last 12 months, we've funded work in some 65 countries. We might think of persecution in the Middle East, but there's in fact increasing suffering to our brothers and sisters through parts of Africa and Asia and South America and a whole range of places where it is becoming increasingly difficult for people to own the name of Jesus. So that is just a brief 2 or 3 minute introduction to the nature of Barnabas Fund. I'm the Australian CEO for Barnabas Fund, and it's my privilege to lead that organisation here in Australia and to be part of that international team working alongside other CEOs in other countries and with our international directors based in England. Focus for today is about strength to follow faithfully. And let me read from the screen because that shows the, the bigger blurb about today, that following Jesus faithfully can be challenging. In this elective, we'll focus on the God who gives us strength to follow, drawing from the experiences of our brothers and sisters who suffer for their faith and placing both their experience and ours within a biblical framework. And so it certainly can be difficult to follow Jesus faithfully. Just let me give you two examples of oppression. And for those who were here yesterday, I'm repeating a little bit about this, but I'm not going to show the videos. If you weren't here yesterday, you missed two videos. One talked about the situation in Armenia, where 100 years ago there was a genocide where millions of Armenian Christians face death, and it is estimated that some 90% of the Armenian Christian population was decimated, was destroyed. And people are still living with that today. And so one of our campaigns is to urge the Australian government to recognise the Armenian genocide. And up here there is a poster about that. We're not allowed to do anything that involves touching, but there is a QR code. And so if you're interested in finding out more about that petition or, in fact, to sign it, you can use that QR code, and that will take you to the page on our website where you can find out more and you can sign that petition if moved. And the situation in Nigeria, we found out yesterday in the video that thousands of Nigerian Christians have been killed in the last 5 years alone. And in particular, in the middle belt of Nigeria, it is increasingly dangerous for followers of Jesus. In the website that we've got about this, we did some fact-checking, and it's over 8,400 Christians have been killed in Nigeria in the last 5 years. And so we've got a campaign on at the moment, and that's what this QR code's about. And we're urging Australian residents to sign an open letter to the Australian Prime Minister, urging him to get the situation in Nigeria onto the agenda for the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting. Nigeria is a member of the Commonwealth of Nations, and so we believe it's important for Commonwealth nations to say something needs to be done. And so again, if you're interested in finding out more, you can use the QR code there. If you just want to make a note of that website, it's savenigerianchristians.org. So one word, savenigerianchristians.org, and that's the site for the Australian open letter. So I'll be here afterwards, and if you're interested in more information, come up and engage with me. Apparently when you're on the stage, you don't have to have a mask because this is a workspace, but that's where the information is about those. I just wanted to repeat that for those who were not here yesterday, without showing the videos again, just to highlight that both historically and in today's world, it is dangerous for people to own the name of Jesus. Can I share with you one of my stories? In 2008, I was involved in a peace building and trauma healing ministry in South Sulawesi in Indonesia. We were based in Makassar. That's the city where only a few days ago there was an attack on a church. And there I had the privilege of meeting Christians from different parts of Indonesia who had survived the jihadi violence at the turn of the century after the end of the Suharto regime. And one of the stories that I'll tell you comes from Poso in central Sulawesi. The capital of central Sulawesi is Palu, and I did have the privilege of meeting the son of Irianto Konkoli, who had been the leader of the Protestant church in central Sulawesi, who was gunned down. The short version is that you might remember that the number of Catholic schoolgirls were beheaded on their way home from school. The Catholic community was devastated, and it was actually Irianto Konkoli, as the leader of the Protestant church, who was seeking justice on behalf of these schoolgirls. And the price he paid for that was that one day he was walking out of a shop holding the hand of his wife in one hand and his eight-year-old daughter on the other, and some people came up and on motorbikes, as I understand it, and they shot him through the head and killed him. Again, as a way of saying, not only you, but Christians, get know your place. I met his son, who at that stage was training in Makassar at the seminary to become a pastor, what Indonesian people call a pendeta. I heard so many stories, but this one from... So this is actually the funeral of Irianto Konkoli. But the story from Poso was that there had been... some Javanese Muslim jihadis came over, and they landed at Poso, which is a port city, and they were well equipped, and they set about shooting, and again with guns and machetes and all those kinds of things, setting fire to churches and killing Christians. Some thousands of Christians were killed on that one day. And what happened was that when they knew what was happening, the Christians ran up the mountain, because here you can see something called Tentena. Tentena is a largely predominantly Christian village, and so they were running up there to try and seek safety. But there had been some jihadis who were lying in wait on the path, and so they were killing Christians as they fled to safety. And I heard the story of a young man who then would have been no more than 19, at the time I met him, and therefore at the time this happened, he would have been 12 or 13. And I'll never forget the words that were said to me by the interpreter. He spoke, and the interpreter said these words to me. I was there the day that my community was destroyed. I ran for my life, jumping over dead bodies with guns and swords all around me. And I'm almost in tears today recounting that story, and I was almost in tears that day as I heard him say that. He was also in the seminary training to be a pastor. Strength to follow faithfully. Those who suffer for their faith have so much that they can teach us. They can teach us about forgiveness. Yesterday I mentioned about Asia Bibi, the Pakistan lady who was on death row for 8 years for the charge of blasphemy, who at the end of 2018 was released and now she and her husband and children are living in Canada in safety. Well, last year she was being interviewed about the situation, and the question was asked, you know, do you hold anything against those who framed you? This was part of her reply. She said, I am not angry at all. I have forgiven everyone from my heart, and there is no hardness in me. There is patience in me because I learned how to be patient when I had to leave my children behind. What are the things that you and I hold on to that we find really hard to forgive? And yet here she is expressing forgiveness to those who robbed her of 8 years away from her children, of 8 years away from her husband, always wondering whether she would be released or whether she would be killed for something she didn't do. So we can learn a lot about faithfulness and about forgiveness. And so again, on today's topic, strength to follow faithfully, in a sense, I want to let the cat out of the bag rather than leave it right to the end. In the context of what we heard this morning, if when God in Christ calls us and our godly sorrow is a conviction that leads us to commit our lives totally and unreservedly to Jesus Christ, when Jesus truly means more to us than anything else, he will give us the strength to follow faithfully. In a sense, there's no secret. It's about putting God first through Jesus Christ. We find in Luke 14 that Jesus talked about the cost of being a disciple. Let me just read verses 25 to 35 from Luke 14. Now great crowds accompanied Jesus, and he turned and said to them, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Whoever does not bear his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. For which of you desiring to build a tower does not first sit down and count the cost, whether he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, when he has laid a foundation and is not able to finish, all who see it begin to mock him, saying, this man began to build and was not able to finish. Or what king going out to encounter another king in war will not sit down first and deliberate whether he is able with 10,000 to meet who comes against him with 20,000? And if not, while the other is yet a great way off, he sends a delegation and asks for terms of peace. So therefore, any one of you who does not renounce all that he has cannot be my disciple. Salt is good, but if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is of no use either for the soil or for the manure pile. It is thrown away. And then Jesus finishes that teaching by saying, who has ears to hear, let him hear. And I think the challenge for you and for me today is first of all to be hearers of the word. We were challenged in the last session to listen to God. We should be hearers, but we should also be doers. We should hear, and then we should put into practice the things that we're hearing. And again, to repeat, I have a conviction that when Jesus in fact means more to us than our family, than our dreams, than our possessions, than our future, when Jesus truly does mean everything, we will have the strength to follow faithfully, just like Irianto Konkoli, just like that boy who ran for his life in Poso, just like Umar Malindi, whose video you've seen, and many others. We too will have that strength. I just want to flick through to encourage you in this sense, that There's something I found from Bible.org on the internet that I really like. It says, since our Saviour suffered the rejection and agony of the cross, if we follow after him, we must be prepared for the same treatment. If people revile us for being Christians, we must bless them in return. We should never do anything to provoke persecution, but if we suffer for the sake of righteousness, we must entrust our souls to a faithful Creator in doing what is right. Again, for the third or fourth time, if Jesus does mean everything to us, then we will have the strength to follow him faithfully. Back in 2005, I found myself with a couple of others in the Islamic Republic of Iran. And there are a number of stories I could tell, but I just want to share one story. We went to the city of Shush, the Old Testament city of Susa. And there are two things that you can read in the Old Testament about Susa. The first is that that's where Esther was queen. And so the photos on the screen show the remains of the palace where Esther was queen. And it was a great privilege to be able to be walking amongst those ruins and reading the book of Esther. A woman who was courageous, who did what was right at the risk of her own life, because she knew that doing right was what God required of her. And in that same city, there's a monument which reflects Daniel, because that's the other thing for which Susa in the Old Testament is known. That's where Daniel served King Darius and where he was thrown into the lion's den. I'm not going to read from Daniel chapter 6, but if you feel like making a note to read it for yourself later, it would be good for you to do that. The basic story, I'm sure most of you are aware, and that is that Daniel's also already served the Babylonian government, and now the Persians and the Medes have taken over, and now he's in this city of Susa and he's serving King Darius, and because of his faithfulness to God, he's winning favour. And so all the locals are jealous of him. And so we read that these men said, we shall not find any ground for complaint against this Daniel unless we find it in connection with the law of God. They tried to dig dirt on him, and all they could find was that he was a God follower. We won't find any fault in him except if it's in connection with the law of his God. And what a great testimony. What if people looked at me or at you, is that what they'd be able to say? We can't find anything to hold against you except in connection with the fact that you're a Christian. Mm-hmm. What then happened was that the locals decided that they were going to set Daniel up. So they went to King Darius and they said, please make a law. And all laws of the Medes and Persians couldn't be unwritten. And basically said, for the next 30 days, we want to make sure that there's a law that says nobody can appeal to or pray to or petition anybody else or any other god except for you. Otherwise, they'll be thrown into the lion's den. And so Darius did that. And so he signed that into law. And then we read that when Daniel knew that the law had been signed, he went to his house where he had windows in his upper chamber towards open towards Jerusalem. He got down on his knees three times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he had done previously. And so Daniel was just faithful. Daniel didn't go out into the street and make a strong sign of defiance saying, yeah, you reckon I'm going to do this? Daniel just did what he always did, and that was to bow in his bedroom, as we would call it, and to pray. But that was against the law, and so he was thrown into the lion's den. Now, King Darius was aware that he'd been tricked, but the law was the law, and so into the lion's den Daniel needed to go. And what's interesting is that if you were going to go to the city of Shush, the Old Testament city of Susa today, you would find this monument. And that's Daniel's tomb. And you would go there and you would find Iranian Muslims taking off their shoes and going in and bowing and praying to their God, giving thanks for Daniel. They've got no idea why. But that's Daniel's legacy of faithfulness. I'll tell you this story. A fellow called Ramon was our taxi driver and interpreter for the day. And at first he thought that because we were interested in all these Old Testament sites that we were Jews. I was a pastor at the time. I was pastoring a church in Sydney. And so he started a conversation and he said, Mr. Ashley, are you Jews? And he was clearly concerned about that. And I said, no, we're followers of Isa. Now, I'm not suggesting that the Islamic Isa is the same as Jesus. So I was using a word that he would identify with. And I didn't say, no, we're Christians. In a sense, what that's saying is, I thought you were in the Jewish box, but I'm going to put you in the Christian box. I tried to answer in a way that got the conversation still going. And so I said, no, we're followers of Isa. And I could see him thinking, and he said, Mr. Ashley, I know about Isa, but what does it mean to follow Isa? And again, being cautious that that might have been a trap, I said, are you sure you want to know? And he said, yes. And I told him what it meant to follow Jesus. And so this was before we'd been to Daniel's tomb, and then after we'd been here, he felt a bit more at ease. And he said, Mr. Ashley, Daniel was a Jewish prophet, wasn't he? I said, yes, he was. He said, and we don't like the Jews. Again, I'd been told to be careful, so I just said, I have heard that. And he said, so why do we Iranian Muslims revere Daniel, a Jewish prophet? And I said, do you really want to know? He said, yes. I said, would you let me read from what we call the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures, one of your holy books? Would you let me read from what we call Daniel chapter 6? And he said, yes. And I was able to read the proclamation of King Darius after Daniel came out of the lion's den that said, the God of Daniel is the one true God. And I said to this man, I said, you revere Daniel because he served your country well. That's Daniel's legacy of physical monument. And I want to say to you that if Jesus means more to us than anything, and we have the strength to follow him faithfully, that faithfulness has its legacy. Now, your legacy and my legacy may not be a monument like that, and frankly, you look at that and say, I'm not sure that I'd want that. But our legacy may very well be living on in the lives of our family or of our church or of our community. My father is a Welshman who came to Australia when he was only 17, and he'd never had anything to do with Jesus in any significant way in his life, except, of course, he'd been christened as a baby. And he encountered Jesus in an incredible way. He'd known death in his own family, and when he moved out here and he asked Mum out, Mum was a Christian young lady, and she said, I'll go out to you if you come to church with me. And he thought that was a bit weird, but Mum was a looker, and so he said yes, and he kept on saying yes. What he didn't know was that Mum at the time had to leave school to care for her dying mum of bowel cancer. Mum was only 16. And it was when my grandmother died, when my mum was a teenager, that Dad, having sat under the gospel preaching for some months, maybe longer, he saw how a Christian family dealt with death. And he saw in my mum's family, he saw a legacy of faithfulness. He saw something of what Paul wrote to the Thessalonians about when he said, we don't grieve as those without hope. And that for my dad was the clincher that the preaching that he'd heard must be true. And so at a time when my grandfather was grieving the loss of his wife, my dad went to my grandfather who led him to the Lord. And I can stand here saying, I'm pleased that I have that legacy living on in me and my children. Putting it bluntly, I wouldn't be here except for that. There's no way Mum was going to marry someone who wasn't a Christian. But there is a legacy of faithfulness. And it can be living out in your life, in the lives of your family, or it can become part of your story just like that's part of mine. And so I want to close by sharing a story of a young boy. I mentioned yesterday that my wife works at Staines Memorial College, a college in Ipswich named in honour of Graham Staines, who was martyred with his two boys in India just over 20 years ago. And last year, my wife was taking her Year 10 class for devotions, and she was talking with them about Daniel and how that even though Daniel knew that there was a penalty, he was faithful. And one of the students in the class, my wife tells me, just said, "Why didn't he fake it?" Is that what you would do? Is that what I would do? Just fake it. My wife rang me and said, "Is it possible that for next devotions you can come and talk to them about the work you do?" And I talked about Daniel and how that Daniel was delivered from the lion's den. I showed them the video of Umar Malindi that I've shown you today. There are a number of African students in that class. And so I showed that video. Again, a man who was delivered. And then I said to them, "But let me share a story that isn't about an old person, isn't someone who lived a long time ago or lives a faraway place. Let me tell you a story from just 20 years ago from nearby Indonesia about a boy who was 15. And as I told the story of Roy Ponto, whose photo is on the screen, they expected the finish of the story to be that he was delivered in this life as well. The brief story is that he, with other people in his youth group on the island of Ambon in East Indonesia, had they'd been to a youth camp, and some extremist terrorists came and they killed the pastor and another leader. And then they turned their attention to the children, the young adults, the teenagers. And one of them went up to Roy Ponto and with a sword come machete raised, said, "What are you?" But he didn't say, "I'm a nothing" or "I'm a Muslim." He said, "I'm a soldier of God." And with that, the machete sword came down and nearly took one of his arms off. And the fellow said again, "What are you?" And he said, "I'm a soldier of God." And with that, it came down a second time. But it didn't kill him. And the third time, the person screamed at him and said, "What's a soldier of God?" And this 15-year-old boy in 1999 in nearby Indonesia said, "A soldier of God is willing to die for Christ." And with that, the sword came down a third time and ended his life. And as he died, he was heard to call out, "Jesus." It's not just for old people. It's not just for biblical times, but it's for you and for me today as well. That if Jesus really does mean everything to us, he gives us that strength to follow faithfully, and there is a legacy. You know, it's one of the reasons I like this book. I'm not supposed to be selling books today, but it's one of the reasons I love this book, Heroes of Our Faith. It's a book that just recounts for 365 days of the year. On every day, there's a story of someone who gave their life for Jesus. It could have been 2,000 years ago. It could have been 15 years ago. And on page 32, it tells the story of Roy Ponto. And so as I read these books, as you read these books, we are encouraged by the legacy of their faithfulness. So thank you so much for being willing to be here today. Perhaps I will finish with those last few verses from Luke 14 where Jesus says, "Salt is good, but if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is of no use either for the soil or for the manure pile. It is thrown away. He who has ears to hear, let him hear."